Hello and welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm your host, Tim Miller. I'm here today with Amanda Carpenter. She's back, editor at Protect Democracy, Renaissance woman at Protect Democracy Everything, Democracy Saver. What's going on, Amanda?
Not too much. Happy to be back. Happy Friday. How are you doing with the daily pods?
It's been going pretty good, I think. You know, we're trying to mix it up a little bit. And tell you, it's like every morning. There's no doubt about that. It happens every morning. So, you know, that's a little bit of a change.
Yeah, well, you have been mixing it up, like the array of guests. I know it looks great on the outside, but I'm just wondering about you adjusting to daily grind. I listened to the commercials about you having to take things to counteract the drinks to get up in time do the pod. So I'm just checking on you, Tim.
I do have a young child and a social life. And I will say, I was going to mention this during the we're doing a mailbag at the end so people can stay around. Okay. I was going to mention this in the mailbag segment, but since you asked me and I've taken over the host responsibilities, you know, Jazz Fest is here the next 2 weeks. And so, yeah, if I'm going a little slow on Fridays, ask a little grace, all right? It's going to be a long year, a tough year. We got to fucking watch Donald Trump every day. And I live in New Orleans, so sometimes I'm going to have a few cocktails. But I am going to still effort to just strap it on, as JVL would say, the chin strap. We're talking about the chin strap. And put out a good podcast every day.
I'm with Sarah on that one.
I appreciate your concern, though. I appreciate your concern. And let me know if you feel like I'm falling short, people. I'm here for you. All right. While we're having fun, Donald Trump was at trial. I want to hear a little bit from him after the court yesterday.
It's a shame. It's a shame. And I'm sitting here for days now, from morning till night, in that freezing room. Freezing. Everybody was freezing in there. And all for this...
So cold. Poor little Donnie. So cold in there. I would have put on a sweater. What do you think? Do you feel bad? I noticed you're wearing some merch, actually. You're wearing some Bulwark merch. Never Trump from the jump. Everybody go to thebulwark.com. Click on store. You can look like Amanda. What do you think about poor cold Donnie in trial yesterday?
I was thinking of the Beyonce song, This Ain't Texas, But This Ain't Mar-a-Lago. I mean, You can't control the temperature in the courtroom. Yes, it's very difficult. But more broadly, I understand a lot of people have hangups about how the trial is going, what's going to happen, et cetera. It is still extremely productive and healthy for us at this stage, even if he gets off and everything, that he has to show up. He is showing up. He does have to do as the judge says. You know, he can't control the circumstances.
Yeah. You're not in charge, big guy.
Yeah. He will be judged by a jury of his peers. Those aren't his sycophants, his political appointees, his fanboys at Fox News. They're New Yorkers, right? Like, even though you're a former president, you are going to be judged by New Yorkers who were pulled in at random because those are actually your peers. And so, I don't know. I get a little like... Yay America watching this, because it shows that even though we have a lot ahead of us, the rule of law is holding. We do have systems designed to do this. I mean, we've tried mob bosses, all kinds of things before. We can do this. We can do this, people. And we're going to go through the process. And that's very, very healthy.
New Yorkers are spicy too. The jury selection has been fun. I keep coming up to that word the cold salad where it's all mixed together, the salmagundi. I'm like, it's like just the whole human experience. You know, you got everybody. You got the deviled egg in there and you got the cold pasta and you know, you got the guy in the t-shirt that says sarcasm font. It's a weird crowd and Trump's going to have to deal with it. On the more serious side of this, or earnest, maybe less than serious, Crystal and Egger wrote this morning that like, we're in this situation where there are more than 12, it is now settled on 12, but there were dozens of people that are trying to do their best, you know, that are trying to live up to the expectations of a country with a rule of law. There's a judge that's trying to do that. There are lawyers. And there's just one asshole that's trying to break all the rules and wants to be treated differently and wants to be treated specially, and that we continually have to rein him in. And it's just unfortunate that that is the person that, like, is the former president of the United States, you know?
Yeah.
We got some good people in there, though, which I like. Okay, we'll see. We'll see how it goes. I want to quote your boss, I guess, Ian Bassett over there, Protect Democracy. We love to Protect Democracy. This is what he wrote about this. There isn't another defendant in the country who could thumb their nose at pretrial conditions of release the way Trump has and remain walking free. Not one. Trump has been given special treatment that no one else would get. If you'd done what Trump has done, you'd be in jail. We all know that listening to the Bulwark podcast, but I like that he said that so bluntly. And I think that's important to continue to say, because I think there are a lot of normies out there that, you know, haven't ever been arrested, don't know how the process is supposed to work, you know, who maybe are buying his thing that he's getting treated badly when that's just not right.
Yeah, I mean, this has kind of been this thing, too. It's like, oh, well, they're violating my constitutional rights and that I can't threaten and intimidate jurors, witnesses, prosecutors, and judges. And their family members, right? Like, that's another big aspect of this. If people want to go deeper on this, there was a really good piece in Politico from their legal affairs editor talking about all the special treatment that he's gotten through this process. And I do think people are sort of reflexively, they don't like the idea of gag orders because it's like, well, he should be able to defend himself. But I wrote a piece for our Protect Democracy Substack called If You Can Keep It, Subscribe to It, talking about how...
Little Ben Franklin call back there. Little Ben Franklin call. Yeah.
Isn't that cute? You know, I was a little unsure about it first, but it has grown on me. And I really do like the name, If You Can Keep It. But the threat that underscores not just this hush money trial, but all the trials is how he tries to continually destabilize our institutions of accountability with threats and intimidation, right? And that spurs people to violence. And it's all for the purpose of obstructing legal proceedings. We saw this on January 6th. We see how he tries to undo accountability for that riot by promising pardons. And now we see how he's trying to intimidate the process in these trials. And there is a reason why not just the judge in this trial, but judges in other trials, and even Eileen Cannon has had to speak to the fact that Donald Trump's rhetoric does pose a threat to the process. That is the reason why we have the gag orders. You are not allowed to interrupt the proceedings in this way, and that's so you can protect it. And we have to have that kind of protection, because if a judge or witnesses or members of the jury are afraid to do their job, the whole institution falls apart. It is just like we kind of saw Congress fall apart in the second impeachment, where members of Congress were afraid to impeach the president because of the threat of violence. And so you see this coming at it from all angles. And I do think it is hard to track, because we look at like, oh, okay, this is the hush money trial, and this is the this, and this is the that. This is the big thing swirling around all of it, about how he wants to destabilize our institutions with threats of violence. And so I just want people to keep that in their head. And that is what the gag orders are designed to protect. And that is why the gag orders must be enforced.
Amen. And much better put than I've been talking, putting it on here. So I'll just leave you and Ian on that one. You also, I was going to get to this later, but you mentioned the promising of the pardon. So let's just get right to it. You wrote for The Bulwark this morning with Grant Tudor, your colleague at Protect Democracy, "Trump is wrong. The pardon power is not absolute." It's interesting. A lot of what you guys are doing at Protect Democracy is kind of looking around corners, potential threats. Nobody wants to close their eyes and imagine that Donald Trump's the president again, but somebody's got to be prepping for that in case that happens. Talk to us about this element of it, because I've always thought that, to me, it's underappreciated, you know, the potential danger of just the specter of pardons that Trump puts forth, you know, that would like, that makes people feel like they can act with immunity. And, you know, I think that'd be very scary in the process of people who are bureaucrats, of course, you know, who have the power of the government state behind them. It's also very scary just in the concept of like the Jan 6 folks, and like that people that are doing political violence might feel like, even if they don't actually, they might feel like they're going to get pardoned. So anyway, talk about the limits of the pardon power and what you, the kind of work you guys are doing on that.
Yeah, well, just to kind of level set, this is where we see an area of concern for a possible Trump 2.0, but just generally as well. In the fact that people sort of implicitly accept the idea that the pardon power is unfettered. And that is largely because presidents have policed themselves within constitutional constraints. Sure, you did see like pardons like Bill Clinton got accused of a quid pro quo with Mark Rich, and then, you know, Congress did an investigation. Trump got away with a lot of pardon abuse. Like, he was issuing pardons for Jeanine Pirro's ex-husband. He had what I call henchman pardons that were in the full light of day for Paul Manafort, Steve Bannon, Mike Flynn, et cetera.
And the Paul Manafort pardon was literally treasonous. I wrote, like, I think that was the headline I wrote. I either wrote treasonous or traitorous. Like, there's just no way to put any, you know, better spin on it than that. It was absolutely disgusting. But it was in this, that period of time where there's so much happening, like the news cycle just moves on.
Yeah, and those henchmen pardons in those veins for those allies affiliated with the Russian investigation were pretty much for the purpose of obstructing justice, like saying, don't break you know, I don't want you to break hold strong. And then voila, you get a pardon later. Okay. So going forward, he will be, if he's elected, even right now, if he's the only person in the position to even test the idea of a self-pardon, because we haven't had presidents accused of criminality in not one, but numerous courts around the country. So we do have to think very seriously about this. And he said before, I do think it's absolute and complete, essentially saying, I think I can do whatever you want. And you even see some constitutional scholars kind of like agree with him, but that is largely rested on the idea that it hasn't been tested yet. Like, just because the idea hasn't been tested or the Supreme Court hasn't like made a decision on the self-pardon doesn't mean it's unconstitutional. Somebody like pushed back on me on Twitter about this today. It's like, listen, like I haven't jumped off a building, but I know I can't fly. And that is because the Constitution, you can't pick and choose parts of it, right? Like you have to read it as a whole document. And you can't let the 20-word pardon clause be a free pass to run roughshod over the rest of the Constitution. Like, we didn't break apart from the English monarchy so a future president could be like, oh, pardon clause, and now I can be a tyrant again and self-pardon myself and reward criminality in any way I see fit. That is not what it's for. It has constraints, and that constraint is you cannot use the pardon power to violate other clauses of the Constitution. Lots of other things are read like that, like the Commerce Clause. Congress has the ability to regulate commerce, but they can't say like, oh, I don't like this paper run by a black editor for these issues, therefore you can't ship it across state lines. That's just not how it works. And so in this paper that we published on Bulwark, which is based on a larger report that my much smarter than me colleague Grant Tudor and Justin Florence did, talks about the four constitutional constraints and the way that we see this should not be used if it ever did come up, primarily to place the president above the law, but then also to license lawbreaking, which is clearly what the January 6th pardons would do in rewarding that kind of political violence to advance the president's aim. So there's ways to go deeper on that, but like this is part of getting ahead of that question. Should it come up, we need to test the idea that it is unfettered, because it absolutely is not. The court has ruled, you know, put restrictions on it in the past. Congress has investigated it. So I just want people to become familiar with the idea that it is not absolute.
Yeah, it's good. The one thing that jumped out at me in the piece was this is not untested, right? The Supreme Court has put limits on presidential pardons before. Yeah. You know, it's kind of a complicated case. There's an example that you give of where essentially it seems like Woodrow Wilson was trying to pardon a newspaper editor preemptively so that they would testify, and you know, essentially that the court held that the power of the president of the Constitution to grant pardons, but you know, does not also change the Fifth Amendment right of a witness, right, to not testify against, I assume it was against the president in this case, but
yeah, the one thing that is not tested is the self-pardon,
right?
Yeah, that's like where people are like, well, we don't know what would happen, like he might be allowed to do it because we haven't had a president do it before. No, like let's read the Constitution as it is written. I think any reasonable person can come to the conclusion that a self-pardon to violate other clauses of the Constitution would not be constitutional.
Amen. I love that. Okay, I'm glad that that's getting out there into the bloodstream.
We're getting wonky on Friday morning,
Tim. We're getting wonky. We're starting with wonky because trust me, we've got some dessert coming. Okay. We got some dessert.
Okay.
All right,
got it.
But before we get to the dessert, I guess we have to compliment Mike Johnson again after the second straight podcast. I'm okay with it. Yeah. Will Salatan and I went deep yesterday on just, you know, kind of the Augustinian moral questions about you deal with a sinner who does the right thing, who comes to the Lord. So anyway, we've had a rules committee vote pass since we met yesterday, 9-3, all the Democrats voting with, I guess, a bare majority of the Republicans. 3 voted against the rule to advance this package of aid bills and then the weird TikTok, you know, 4th grab bag to the floor. Now that's got to pass a rules vote on the floor, but it seems like it's going to. There's some Republican Twitter back and forth this morning between the various you love Republican on Republican infighting. It was like, I love crazy on crazy infighting, especially it was like Derek and Van Orden was shouting at Matt Gaetz on Twitter. I'm like, all right, we're in business now. So anyway, there's some frustration within the Republican conference, but it's going to come up for a vote. Hasn't happened yet. We're taping this Friday morning, but it seems like we're on path to this passing. And it's just, I guess my questions for you is, number one, is this, how many cheers do we give Mike Johnson for this? And two, is this the growing on the job everybody told us that Trump was going to do? But like, it turned out Mike Johnson did it. Like, you know, you can be irresponsible and you have a childish job as a backbench congressman, but all of a sudden you're in a skiff and you're seeing video of Ukraine get attacked and you get serious. Is that, do you think, what happened here?
I am not prepared to say that Mike Johnson has turned a corner and has seen the light. Okay. What I am prepared to do is say that Tim Miller was right.
All right.
And I've been screaming this in my head as I've seen this kind of come together. But this really nailed it for me in the Politico Playbook newsletter this morning. Okay. It says, new House rules. Welcome to coalition government.
Welcome to coalition government. Thank you, Amanda.
Like, Tim Miller has called that shot. I mean, it's kind of obvious, but like, this is the Tim Miller thesis coming to light because it is the obvious conclusion. It is the only way to go forward. And if Mike Johnson wants to say, well, I did it because what I saw in the skiff, even though anybody can turn on the news and listen to any speech by Zelensky to come to that conclusion,
fair point.
I guess I'll take it. But the only reasonable conclusion to come from this is that Tim Miller's right.
Thank you. I'm so glad you mentioned that because I was just checking Joe Strauss, the Texas Speaker, who I hope listens because he should, because he's just like a core bulwark Republican, ended up as a literal coalition speaker because the Republicans couldn't get their shit together in Texas. And so he won the speakership with the votes of some Republicans and some Democrats in Texas. We had an article about in the Bulwark. I recruited a Texas journalist to write for us about what the model would look like for Congress. And that would have been better, like a literal coalition government where like Brian Fitzpatrick or Don Bacon was the speaker. Like, these people aren't perfect, but it would have been preferable to Mike Johnson, and we would have had Ukraine aid many months ago instead of now.
Yeah.
But an unofficial coalition government where the Democrats kind of wink, wink, nod, nod and say, hey, we'll save you, Mike Johnson, is better than the alternative, you know? And that's like where we're at.
Walks like a duck, talks like a duck. They won't say I'm a duck. But you're a duck. You're a coalition government.
It's a coalition government. It's a coalition government duck. That's exactly right. Me and Gates have been going back and forth on this on Twitter this morning a little bit.
I didn't see it.
Because my point going back was that had Kevin McCarthy, that just gutless, blow-dried piece of garbage.
You're talking about Donald Trump's future chief of staff there, Tim Miller.
Or maybe VP. He floated himself for VP in the New York Times. I don't know if you noticed that. The New York Times was doing a story on VPs. I wish I had it in front of me.
Well, since RFK turned it down. So Kevin McCarthy jumped out.
Yeah, the New York Times was doing this story. Mike Bender is a great reporter. He was doing this story on categories of people that Trump's looking at for VP. And weirdly, Kevin McCarthy is on the record quoted in it. And we'll put the link in the show notes so you can see the exact quote. But like, his quote is like, you know, Donald Trump really needs somebody that he knows is loyal, that has experience working the halls of Congress, that can get his agenda passed. And I'm like, wait a minute. Is this Kevin nominating himself for VP? I think it was.
I mean, I guess he has experience getting fired by Trump before. So he's qualified for the
job. That's true. That's relevant on the job experience.
He knows how to pick out the Starburst.
None of these people will listen to me. They'll all be like, oh, you guys have TDS. This would never happen. Had Kevin McCarthy just listened to us and gone to a few normal Democrats and said, hey, guys, I know you're mad at me, but let's cut a deal. Da-da-da-da-da. We're going to do this. You guys get this. I get this. He would still be speaker. And the Republicans would still have a bigger majority because that motion to vacate was only powerful if the Democrats were going to vote against him, right? Gates only had 9 people.
Well, as I remember, the Democrats were not willing to entertain that because of what he did about January 6th.
And so maybe it never would have happened. But I just think if there's a hypothetical world where Kevin humbled himself.
Yeah, he didn't
went
try.
To Hakeem, yeah, he didn't try. Had he humbled himself and went to Hakeem Jeffries instead of just going on TV and dunking on Democrats and blaming Democrats, saying, oh, the Democrats are going to put a crazier person in. Remember that argument? And like, we got chastised by people on right-wingers who were like, you guys are Democrats. You're going to put a crazier person in because of Kevin McCarthy because you have so much TDS. It's like, look what happened. The Democrats did it.
Yep.
They got rid of Kevin McCarthy. They got a person that's maybe crazier and is like, you know, if you're going down a checklist of views, but it's turned out to be more responsible.
Yeah,
it's turned out to be more responsible with Kevin McCarthy. So it ends up being a good trade for everybody.
Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed.
It hasn't happened.
You're right. You're right.
Fingers crossed.
We're knocking on wood here. Okay.
Just get that money to Ukraine. Like, get it. Get it done.
There's one topic I didn't prepare you for.
Uh-oh.
Because I thought it'd be funnier to see you live.
Okay.
I hope you haven't seen this. Politico was reporting on this yesterday. Olivia Beavers, good reporter. This is what's happening with the House Freedom Caucus right now because they're in such shambles. The House Freedom Caucus members are signing up to take shifts to guard the House floor in order to prevent resolutions they'd consider unsavory from slipping through that could curb their power under this new rule, per to our sources. This floor action response team aims to guard against a voice voter, et cetera, et cetera. I just want to note, floor action response team. That's an interesting acronym. Floor action response team.
Okay.
it's the fart team. The House Freedom Caucus has created a fart team to try to stop the Democrats and Mike Johnson from doing anything they don't like.
Good.
So, thoughts on that,
Amanda? Yeah, I mean, it kind of reminds me of what we would do in DeMint's office. I mean, it's sort of a function of what was called the Senate Steering Committee, but there would be somebody that would police, or I don't want to say police, but monitor the phone line that bills would go to the floor at all hours on weekends and things like that to make sure that nothing would be called up for unanimous consent and be passed. Mm. That seems kind of familiar to me, okay. Although they could work on their messaging a little bit and come up with something better.
You're not going to take the bait on the stink bomb, on Paul Gosar putting a stink bomb on the House floor. You're not going to take any bait on that. You're just going to... YouTube viewers of the podcast might want to see Amanda's visual reaction, but you're being very responsible as a mother in your words.
Well, I had in my head, I thought it was going to be... Wasn't it the tweet from Sean Davis essentially saying, like, the real nuclear option is for more Republicans to resign so that the House is deadlocked and nothing can happen from here on out? And it was like...
Great.
Resign your job to own the libs.
It's please,
like,
own us.
Go for that. Please do that. We would get a better coalition government in the House. It's just like, okay, do that. Please do that. Take Sean Davis's advice. That would be wonderful. Go forward.
Own us. Yeah. Sean Davis here is if the exact number of Republicans resigned to make it even Republicans versus Democrats, then you can't elect a speaker. Who the fuck? These people are lunatics. Okay. But please resign to own me. All right. Do we want to do happy or sad first? We're going to look at a couple of comments yesterday from former Trump cabinet officials. Do you want happy first or sad first?
I mean, just let's get the sad first so we can go on.
Okay, let's get it out of the way. Let's hear from Bill Barr.
And I also know you've been asked many times. You've had your disagreements with the former president. He's the presumptive nominee. We assume he will be the nominee. Will you support him in 2024?
Well, I've said all along, you know, given two bad choices, I think it's my duty to pick the person I think would do the least harm to the country. And in my mind, that's I will vote the Republican ticket.
You will.
I will support the Republican ticket. I think the real danger to the country, the real danger to democracy, as I say, is the progressive agenda. And while Trump, and I said, Trump may be playing Russian roulette, but continuation of the Biden administration is national suicide, in my opinion.
Oh. F you, Bill Barr. Ugh. I have some thoughts on Bill Barr, but Amanda, I want you to have the floor first.
I mean, I guess he's consistent, right? I mean, he's kind of like maintained this. There's this continuing idea, even echoed by George Will in the Washington Post, talking about how, well, Trump and Biden are both equally bad. And actually, you know, if you really look at it, Biden is kind of worse. Please point me to an instance where Joe Biden has asked the Justice Department to seize voting machines and rerun an election, where Joe Biden is accused of criminality in multiple jurisdictions. You can get away with saying this on Fox. I don't know. Was this Fox Daytime? I don't know where it
was. Fox Daytime. Yeah. Fox Afternoon.
Sounds about right. You get no pushback. You have to do no serious inflection.
Bill Hemmer's like, you got some disagreements. Disagreements is an interesting word for it. I mean, Bill Barr did say that he thinks that Donald Trump has a credible criminal case against him for mishandling classified information, that he lied to the country, and that his lies caused the storming of the Capitol. You could call those disagreements, I guess. It seems a little bit understated for what was his actual criticisms.
I mean, I would like to see just a little bit of not even pushback, but hey, Bill Barr, could you tell me more about how you think the progressive agenda is suicide? Like, what part of it? Is it the CRT in classrooms that you don't like? Is it the book that you're afraid a kid might read? Like, what part of it makes it national suicide? I mean, because it just sounds so
specifics,
like,
please.
Absurd on its face. I mean, Green New Deal, is it because some protesters accosted Lisa Murkowski, which was bad the other day? I don't
horrible.
Know if you saw that. That was just really gross and
horrible.
Disgusting.
Those people are disgusting.
I mean, yeah. Take a shot at that. But that's not national suicide.
Yeah. Well, how does a suicide look? Can you just paint it out? Like what? Like what's going to happen by 2028? Like the, what is the, what's going to happen with the country? Is Antifa going to take over? I just like, what is the hypothetical suicide? You know, Bill Barr lives in McLean in a beautiful house. He's got a good life. His tax rates aren't really particularly high. You know, the U.S. economy is doing better than its global competitors. There's not immigrants storming McLean right now. And like, there are problems for sure, but suicide.
Although I gotta say, like, it's just, I mean, it's not funny, but he says Donald Trump is Russian roulette.
Interesting choice of words there.
It's roulette versus suicide.
It's also kind of like, maybe you should play Russian roulette if you feel that way. Also, Russian roulette like makes it seem like it's not that serious, but it's kind of like, I'd like to see Bill Barr give Russian roulette a try and see if he actually would pull the trigger. I think probably not.
All right, Tim, you don't mean that. You mean that metaphorically.
No. I think, no, my point is I don't want him to kill himself. I think, well, would he actually pull the trigger? I think probably not, right? So like he's saying that he's going to vote for Donald Trump and that that's Russian roulette. But like the metaphor doesn't really work because if I handed Bill Barr a gun and put a bullet in one of the chambers and spun it and then handed it to him and put it up to his head and said, will you pull the trigger right now? Your other option is Joe Biden being president for 4 years. It'd be an interesting, if Bill Barr has any friends listening, we can try it. It'd be great content.
It is irresponsible for Bill Barr to say because no one is playing that game.
Right, exactly.
That is not a good metaphor because it doesn't come even close to being analogous to the situation that we're in.
If I thought that Donald Trump was Russian roulette, I would not do it because I would not play Russian roulette. Yes. I guess that's my point. Yes. I would not vote for somebody that I thought was Russian roulette because I wouldn't play Russian roulette. I want to read one more thing about Bill Barr. I think it's gotten missed. Because I hadn't seen it. Former Attorney General Bill Barr will help lead a new group formed by a business lobbying organization that aims to be an alternative to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the massive advocacy group that has fallen out of favor with some Republicans. So I think we know what he really means here. He's got some big conservative business leaders that are unhappy that the Chamber of Commerce has not gone full MAGA. And so he's now getting paid to lead a lobbying organization that is like to the right of the Chamber of Commerce. And so he needs to represent the interests of those people. That's what's actually happening here.
Okay, so Bill Barr will play Russian roulette because he wants to form a new Chamber of Congress. That's what brings him to the table for this game.
And doesn't like some of the regulation cuts. Yeah.
Doesn't sound that brilliant and smart to me for a guy who has such a fine pedigree.
Okay. Mark Esper. We'll start to uplift the spirits a little bit. Actually, maybe we'll wait for Mark Esper while we're down here in the muck. One of the other things I wanted to talk to you about. Last time you were on, we talked a little bit about Project 2025 and kind of the broader concerns about that. I kind of want to dig into that a little bit more, just particularly, you know, with regards to kind of what you guys are preparing for as and threat assessment. And we were talking about a little bit about this before. So let's talk about that. And then we'll get into Mark Esper, because I think it's very related.
Just more broadly, when I look online and I see some of the chatter and what's in the air, a lot of people view Project 2025 as this existential threat. I prefer, and the approach I've taken at Protect Democracy in our report about the Authoritarian Playbook 2025 is not to look solely at that document produced by Heritage. What is most concerning is where that document has the Venn diagram with the Trump agenda in the middle part, where the conservative movement and Republican Party is largely coalescing in authoritarian ways. Broadly, what Project 2025 is espousing through all the different policies is that they want a really powerful executive, right? They want the president to be able to enact his agenda throughout the federal government and think that loyalists should be installed at every level so that there's no one essentially that says no to the president's agenda. Like, that's the thing emanating from all of this. And so whether you look at their proposals for the Department of Justice or the Department of Education or the Health and Human Services, that is what it gets at. And there's many areas of overlap, in particular regarding the Department of Justice, in which they think they have language in there that speaks to how a president should be able to communicate to the prosecutors and stuff. There shouldn't be firewalls of communication to protect judicial independence. They want to do away with that. And then when you see Donald Trump take that policy to the logical extension, he's talking about how, okay, I'm going to weaponize the department to go after my political enemies. So you kind of have the smarty tart Heritage people talking about like, oh, on a policy level, we think this should change. And then you have Donald Trump on the campaign trail saying, this is how I would use those changes to go after my enemies. And so the way that Donald Trump gets away with this stuff is that a bunch of people in the news look at Project 2025 and they say, oh, this is bad. This is what we're going to do. And he goes, I didn't say that. Meanwhile, you know, on Agenda 47, which is his actual campaign platform, in his words, written, printed, scripted out in campaign speeches, he is telling you exactly how he will do that. And so I just like the emphasis to be on what he is promising to do, which is what we did with the authoritarian playbook, 2025.org. You can go find it, where it shows how these things marry together, how he would abuse his powers as president in 2025 to enact the authoritarian agenda that Heritage buys into now and is laid out in their own 900-page document. So don't go through all that. Just read what I put together and keep in mind the big idea here is they want the president to do whatever he wants. Article 2 power, whatever I want. That's basically what they're saying.
This is the key part. And we got into this a little bit with Ross on Tuesday, which was like, you know, his argument was, well, you guys, your case against Trump is resting on the theory that the people around him will be different next time and that it'll be worse next time, yeah, right? Yeah. Because it won't be the same.
Yes, sir.
And my point is like, well, yeah, obviously, they're saying that it will be different next time. They are saying, yep. I'm not saying it. It's not TDS. And I think this is, well, I'm glad you kind of put a finer point on this, right? Because it's like, they are specifically saying, you know, the whole objective here is to install people throughout the bureaucracy that are not going to put brakes on Trump because he had too many brakes put on him last time. That's what they're saying, right? And so there's reason to believe when you combine that with the other knowledge about the fact that he's not going to have people like Mark Esper around next time, you know, where it's pretty obvious, like the difference and the nature of the threat.
Yeah, and it's kind of a 1-2 punch, right? Like, there's been a lot of tension on Schedule F, which was his executive order that he tried to put into place in October 2020, but didn't have time to do an action, which essentially reclassify federal employees so that he had the ability to fire more of them. So he's already promised, like, yeah, we're definitely doing that on steroids as much as we can on day one of my next administration. But you couple that with the fact that he's ousting people, number one, and then Heritage has this massive job bank to screen people for ideological purity, commitment to enacting the president's agenda first, unfailingly. And then that's who's coming in to do it. And then, you know, on a policy level, they really want these monitors essentially accountable who answer to the president at every level. And we're not just talking Department of Justice. You're talking places like EPA.
Homeland Security.
Imagine that in every department. I mean, you saw the craziness with the Weather Service in his first administration, where they wanted to alter the maps potentially with the Sharpie so it would help him politically. We saw this pushing this to some degree with the FDA, with the vaccine approval and games that they played with that. Yes. And so you don't want all this to become so politicized, but that is the goal so that they can use leverage in any way possible. And just to put this in the authoritarian context, the reason why this becomes so dangerous is that once an executive like this consolidates all this power, right? Like you have all your appointees, you're pushing your agenda, you know, regulatory retaliation, all this stuff. You can't give it up. You can't allow your enemy to win because once they take that power, they're probably going to hold you accountable, right? And so that is why authoritarians never leave. That's why you see someone like Putin who's never going to leave office. You see Orban win again and again. That's how it works. And it's so plainly obvious when you study how authoritarians come to power and how they stay there and why, whether he knows it or not, he's following that playbook.
Bill Kristol had a very long conversation with Mark Esper. So folks can listen to that over at Conversations with Bill Kristol. We'll put the link in. I want to play one clip from it and talk a little bit about somebody who's, you know, maybe not getting an A+ on the report card, but doing a lot better than Bill Barr. Here's Mark Esper talking about the letter that he signed with all of the living secretaries of defense in both parties in 2020.
It's kind of what brought us together, particularly as we saw as things unfolded and as the election denialism continued, there was a growing concern that would the military get involved? And we all know now that there was that meeting in late December with, I think maybe it was Mike Flynn and others who said, yeah, maybe we should send the military in to seize ballot boxes or to conduct another election. I can't recall the details, but it was quite alarming that, you know, the military would be put in that context. I was concerned going into the fall that the military would be used at the time of the election, you know, when the results were revealed to put down protests, to do other things. And so that became more of my concern, immediate concern at that point in time. And of course, I don't think anybody envisioned that the weeks and months after November 2020 would happen the way they did. I mean, in my lifetime, if you had told me 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago that there would be an insurrection on Capitol Hill and people would storm the Capitol and try and seize ballot boxes and threaten to hang Mike Pence, the vice president, it would be like a bad Hollywood movie, right? But it was real, and it should be a wake-up call for all of us.
It should be a wake-up call. Refreshing just to hear somebody, like, I know that all is kind of a low bar just to say the truth, but like, he's saying the truth about what happened. He's doing the natural follow-up to that, which is not supporting Donald Trump, given the nature of the threat. What do you think about Mark Esper and what we've been hearing from him?
This is good. He seems primarily focused on Trump's potential abuse of the Insurrection Act, which he was on record at the time. He spoke out in real time against it. He got fired for it. So that's good. I'm glad he's doing these interviews. That said, you know, he kind of is in the news a little bit more recently for reasons I don't like. And that's because there was a letter recently signed by another letter, not the letter he signed in 2020, a letter that was released this week from a lot of military officials to the Supreme Court explaining why Trump should not have total immunity, which is another case that Trump is taking to the Supreme Court. You know, this is the other thing that's advancing next week, where he wants total immunity for any alleged potential crimes he committed as president. And so, you know, it was really good that those military officials, which include, I got to look on here, you know, it's people like Mike Hayden, et cetera, other retired generals, saying, like, this is dangerous for the country. And they're primarily really good messengers for this because members of the military are in position to execute these unlawful acts potentially on behalf of a president. When that example came of, well, could the president order SEAL Team 6 to execute his enemies? And they're essentially like, yeah, guess who's going to be ordered to do that in that potential scenario? So you absolutely need officials to speak out. And it's good they did so. But Mark Esper was asked about that letter last week. And he essentially said, I don't think they should be weighing in on this. I don't understand this. That's his right, you know, if that's really his opinion, but I think he should be pressed on it a little bit more, because I think if he engaged in some more reflection and study of this issue, he could get to the right place. And I understand, like, it's an uncomfortable place for, you know, the chain of command to be speaking out against a president, but you're not serving him anymore. The military should not be abused in this fashion. Members of the military should be able to say so and not be put in an uncomfortable position. So I would like him to get on the right side of that issue, because if you're worried about abuse of the Insurrection Act and you're willing to speak out against that, you should be willing to take a position on why the president shouldn't have total immunity for crimes he commits as president.
I concur with that, but I guess I'll say this. If Mark Esper just has a principled view on this, been inside the build, been inside the Pentagon, said that these folks, he doesn't believe that, you know, military officials should be speaking out. Okay, well, he is a civilian. I'm glad he's speaking out now, and he's going to have to be their megaphone this year. And I hope, I'm glad he's on Conversations with Bill Kristol. I hope he supports Joe Biden for president. We'll see. I'd like to see him at the convention. And if not, I'd like to see him in some other venue, paid TV ad, something, using his voice as a civilian leader of the military and somebody that saw Donald Trump up close and personal. And he might do that. I hope he does continue to do that. Now, this is a note of encouragement on that front.
Yeah, when you say speak at the convention, because I think we actually disagree on this one, and that people in his position should be platformed by the Democratic Party to advocate for Biden. I don't think that, like, you know, people like Chris Christie, if people are not comfortable doing so, they're not Democrats, they don't even have to say I'm voting for Biden necessarily. A blanket statement saying, like, I think these things are disqualifying, I don't know who's going to be on the ballot or whatever, but I am going to vote against Trump because he's disqualified. I think that would be sufficient, but maybe we disagree.
I don't know if we strongly disagree, and maybe I'm just in West Wing world, but I'm fine with all that. It's good. Anything is better than nothing. I just, in my head, I just think about my goosebumps when I'm going to be nervous in October. October chill is going to be coming out. And it'd feel nice to see Mark Esper come out on stage in Pittsburgh and just be like, we cannot do this. I saw it up close. It's too dangerous. I'm going to vote for Davos Dave McCormick or whatever. He didn't even live in Pennsylvania, but so he wouldn't say that. But, you know, I'm still a Republican. I'm going to be for a Republican next time, but we got to be for Joe Biden. The country demands it. Country over party, blah, blah, blah. It just would be nice. I don't know. If one person did that, It would just give me the tingles. Would it actually matter? I think it would. I do think it would matter. I'm not going to malign Mark Esper if he doesn't do it, though.
Yeah, I will. So if he says a letter to the Supreme Court by former officials was a bad idea, though, because I think he's wrong on that.
Okay, Mark Esper. Listen to the whole conversation with Bill Kristol. Better than nothing. Glad he's out there. We're going to come back on the other side. We're doing a mailbag. I'm keeping Amanda. Amanda's doing the mailbag, too. We'll see you in a sec. All right, it's Friday. And by the way, I had a very unsubtle playout song for Amanda last time. This time I have a medley of unsubtle playout songs for her. Both of them, it's going to be our first medley. Both of them will be on the Spotify playlist, which is in the show notes every Friday. People who ask, where can I find the songs? Playlist is in the show notes. All right.
Thank you for that. Just because I'm telling you again, I listen to you when I'm on my runs. And so I let it play out all the way to the end of the songs. And I really like it because I get new recs. And so I like it. I
love that. Okay, mailbag. We'll be serious first. That's kind of serious. Many people ask this. Clinton, Virginia, Martin, James, all basically a similar question. I'm going to read Clint's. What about Biden promising to appoint sane Republicans to his administration? Haley back to the UN ambassador. Liz Cheney as Secretary of Ag or Interior. Biden has common ground with some of these people, and these are unprecedented times that require whatever it takes. Several people suggested Secretary of State even for Haley and Cheney. Amanda, what say you?
Yeah, well, you can't really promise positions to people during a campaign, but do it now. I would love that. I mean, I think that there's a lot of places where someone like a Cheney, et cetera, have experience that can be used that aren't necessarily going to interfere with his Democratic agenda. I think that would be fabulous, don't you? Because if you're going to say, like, what I don't like, again, revisiting the whole, like, should Republicans become Democrats? I don't like it when his campaign says, okay, hey, Republicans, there's a place in my campaign for you. Like, you don't want to be used as political pawns. Like, just make room and say, hey, you're welcome here. I don't like it when he takes it to a political place when it could just be like, yeah, we're working together. If he could show, here's how I can work together with Republicans. Yeah, super, super duper. Do that.
Yeah. My thought on this is I have two parts. Number one, I don't know how much this really would help. Right. And so I hate, like, there was a political article in 2020 where there's like some Never Trumpers are grumbling that Joe Biden hasn't promised to put a Republican in the cabinet. I think that one of the examples that are floating was Meg Whitman could be Commerce Secretary. Meg Whitman being Commerce Secretary has literally zero bearing on whether I think that Joe Biden or Donald Trump should be the president, right? And I don't think it should have a bearing on anyone else's view. As a signaling thing, I think picking somebody now and just being a little bit more proactive in demonstrating that this is a big coalition, a big tent, I think that that could be a good PR move and a good signaling move. There are a lot of cabinet positions. I don't think the Secretary of State is right, by the way. I think Biden has enough problems on his left flank in Gaza right now. Anyway, I think Tony Blinken's doing a good job. And so, picking a neocon to be Secretary of State is kind of a ridiculous suggestion. But I think that, you know, for one of these other positions, demonstrating that there's going to be somebody in the cabinet that is a former Republican. I mean, Jeff Flake's already in the administration. Make him move him from Turkey to somewhere, you know, in the United States and do something with that.
He's just invisible.
He's invisible.
Invisible, yeah. Right? I mean, we haven't heard anything. Like, a cabinet position is probably asking a lot, but there's a bazillion task forces and commissions and things like that. Get him involved. Get him involved. Be great.
More is more. Okay. Next question is from Ted. I will say we've had some good life advice questions. We've given such good life advice that somebody's moving to Door County, which we've mentioned several times.
You should have her on and let her know. Have her phone in. You know, make it easy.
Okay. I don't understand why more after listening, just all the amazing advice we've given, we've not been flooded with life advice questions, but that's okay. We have a couple other funny questions anyway. Ted asked, if you were on the board of the Trump Library, which, you know, would never happen, but okay, let's play along.
Wait, please put me on that board.
Amanda's like, sign me up. Sign me up. I don't think you've done any vetting, but I'm ready. What exhibit would you create to bring renewed attention to a Trump event many Americans have memory hold? This is fun. Trump Library. Amanda, what would you do?
Yeah, well, I'm just trying to imagine what the Trump Library would look like. I mean, I see that like the gift shop at Mar-a-Lago. But that's not actually true, because I think they're administered by the National Archives. There's a nonprofit board that's set up. And actually, the Nixon Library is a really good source of information post-Watergate. They house all the transcripts and things that have come out and other books. Like, there can be really, really good sources of information.
It's hard to see Trump going that route.
Yeah, I don't know how much control they have. Usually they raise money for it, and I think they have a hand in appointing the board. But after a period of time, like Q Hewitt was in charge, or he had some role at the Nixon Library at some point, which you can see how that happened. But later on, I think it becomes like kind of more serious, and you can go through all the materials. Oh God, they're going to have all his like social media post archives. That's going to be a trip. But I am still dying to know what happened in Helsinki with what he told Putin and what the translator actually observed. I want a Helsinki like whole walk-in where you actually go through the press conference and they play the words and then you see what happened beside closed doors, because I think that it is really impactful in terms of...
That'd be fun. You'd hear the Russian and then you'd hear the translator.
Yeah, you can put on the headphones.
That'd be fun. An audio experience.
Yeah, I want a Helsinki exhibit. I think A, informative in terms of what's going on with Ukraine. B, I want to know what happened. And C, the rest of everything would probably be so nuts. Can you imagine like someone going into that library and just walking through like a whole wall of tweets 30 years from now? And all like, just you'd be surrounded by it. And he'd be like yelling at you. There, like, there should just be like some kind of audiovisual assault to recreate what it was like living through that in terms of being surrounded by Trump and not being able to get away from it. So that's my fun version.
This sounds more like a haunted house than a library. A little scary. Trump in his orange makeup jumps out at you and yells one of his tweets.
Okay, that's got to be part of it. His makeup kit.
Yeah, the makeup kit's got to be in the library.
Yeah. So I want the makeup kit and one thing like where you can get ready as he does for an appearance. You put on the suit, his beauty uniform. That's what we call it.
There's a beauty uniform
where you wear the same thing every day. It's like the female version of Steve Jobs' turtleneck. So it would be his first outfit, the suit with the long tie and the padding and the heel, like whatever, the hairspray that he uses, the makeup, that'd be good. And then you can change into golf attire, which is the khakis, the polo shirt, the red hat.
Mm.
Yeah, that needs to be part of it. To totally
the man's
embrace.
Ear. He needs kind of a man's ear for his golf shirt.
A man's ear?
Yeah, like the bro, the Seinfeld episode, the male. I know you don't do pop culture. It's like it's a male bra.
Oh.
They call it either a bro or a man's ear.
Spanx for men?
That's Spanx for men. Yeah, you got to put that
man
on.
Man Spanx.
I got to say, I was thinking of what called to mind to me is all the times Trump has been scared. Is this library ever going to happen? I don't know. It's kind of weird that Trump hasn't focused on it. A healthy narcissist, like if Trump wasn't a total sociopathic narcissist, if he was just a normal narcissist, he would have lost the election. And then focused on building the biggest, gaudiest library ever, you know, with the money that he stole from people over the years. And, you know, it would be in South Florida and it would like look like the Taj Mahal and it would make me sick. But like at least that would have been a healthy channeling of narcissism. But instead of, you know, trying a coup and running for president again. But anyway,
I don't think you can make money off it. That's the problem.
It's
supposed to be run as a nonprofit. And it's not really totally administered by you. But that said,
since when has he been limited by norms before?
I want to know what you think about the campaign licensing deal where you have to kick up 5% to the big guy for every time you use his likeness on a mailer, which, by the way, in West Virginia, that is all the direct mail that I get. My mailbox just stuffed full of people saying, I'm a Trump Republican. Like even the billboards that you see, there's a guy running for governor who's like this fighter and talks about how he's going to go punch people. It's got pictures of him ringside. But the billboard says Trump Republican in big letters before it even says his name down below.
It's so weird. I do have more West Virginia thoughts. We'll save it for your next time that you're on. My final thing on the Trump Library, I want a scared corridor because all of my favorite Trump videos are like the one, like I mentioned the other day, the one where the eagle goes to bite him and he gets really scared and he jumps up when he's like, sitting at his desk. Okay, we'll put that. I have another big day for show notes. We got to put the Trump being scared montage, New York Times article, the Spotify playlist, the Other one is when he's on stage. This is one of my favorites. And a protester jumps on the stage, which is a little scary, okay? Yeah. But it was just some liberal, progressive, you know, do-gooder protester, which you shouldn't do that.
No, okay. Don't do that.
But Trump gets so freaked out. He, like, bends down, like it's like a sniper is out to get him. And then they, like, storm him off, and then he runs off. And the next day, he tries to tell people that they thought it was ISIS. I thought it was ISIS.
Oh,
it was
yeah. Like one, I remember you know, that.
He was like, oh, it was ISIS coming after me. And then they tried to advance that lie that it was ISIS when yeah. Really he just got scared by like some hippie tree hugger. Anyway, a scared Trump, that would give me a lot of joy. Amanda, do you have any final thoughts? I'm going to close with a final question that I don't. Do you have any? I assume you don't have any Jazz Fest recs.
I do not.
Okay. I'm going to close with some Jazz Fest recs. You just listen in and then we'll let everybody go. All right. Here's the question. Asa is headed to New Orleans. Good name. Asa Hutchinson are the best Republican candidate for president this year. Low bar. Asa, I'm headed to New Orleans for the second week of Jazz Fest. I'm curious if you have any can't miss event shows or bars. We'll also be taking our 3-year-old. Would love some insight as to recommendations for kids in New Orleans. All right, you guys mark this. I get a lot of New Orleans requests for grown-up recommendations for Jazz Fest. I'm an uptown man. All right, so here's your uptown life. The Maple Leaf, Tipitina's, my buddies own Tipitina's, Rabbit Hole, that's more for hipsters, Le Bon Temps Roulet, it's a divier place. Those are all uptown. Look at their schedules. You can't go wrong. Same with the Toulouse Theater, good name, in the French Quarter. For you, second week of Jazz Fest, I took a peek of Friday Night. There's an Earth, Wind, Fire cover band at Republic. Boyfriend, she's awesome. She's doing Tina Turner at Tips. There's an LCD sound system drummer at Rabbit Hole. Tank and the Bangas are at Toulouse Theater. Amazing. All great options Friday night after the shows. Anything with my good friend Stanton Moore, friend of the pod Stanton Moore. Look at his schedule. He's a drummer. Any late night brass band show, the TBC brass band is probably my favorite. I got to shout out Bulwark Superfan, Steve's Uptown Bar, the Kingpin. Do you find yourself by Britannia and Napoleon Jefferson-ish? Stop the Kingpin for a beer. Tell him I sent you. And if you got the kiddos in tow, Creole Creamery is the best ice cream in the South. That's around the corner. Other food, Laouza's. Am I saying that right? Laouza's. I'm struggling to learn all the New Orleans pronunciations of things. I'm just embracing being a transplant. Their barbecue shrimp is my favorite dish in town. Laouza's. It's right by where Jazz Fest is. Going to be a long line. It's worth it. Get out there either early or just have a beer and wait. Inside Jazz Fest, get the crawfish bread. It's back this year. Kids, the fest is great for kids. Jazz Fest is great for kids. Come next year if you're looking for somewhere to bring your kids. It's not like Coachella. All right, you get there early. Make sure you got your water and your sunscreen and that they're dressed for the heat. Toulouse wore a black jersey last year. She was not happy. So, you know, make sure they're dressed for the heat. My other big kid advice, the aquarium and insectarium is right by the French Quarter. So, you know, you as a parent, you can go get a little hurricane or a little hand grenade or a little adult beverage. Just walk it right over to the aquarium and insectarium. You're walking along the Mississippi River. You can look at the boats. 3-year-olds like big boats. Go in. You see the insects. They serve insect food. It's great. There's a butterfly room. You know, there's other stuff you can do for kids, but you know, you can get those if you just Google it. Insectarium, aquarium, and French Quarter combo is a nice little day. Guys, those are my New Orleans recs. You're welcome. No charge. Straight from me. Thank you for listening to the Borg Podcast. Amanda, this has been so fun. When are you coming to New Orleans?
Although, you know, I'm going to go Google what a hand grenade is because I wasn't aware that it's something you can drink. And I've never heard of an insectarium.
An insectarium.
That sounds interesting.
Would your kids like it, though? I bet they would.
No? Yeah, they'd probably be game. But I do think you need to organize some kind of a Bulwark bar crawl or family-friendly crawl event sometime. Just putting that out there. That would be a lot
Let's
of fun.
Let's do it. Okay. Well, you let me know when you're going to be here. We can tell people I can be like the Pied Piper. We can take people around. Everybody, I want you to have a wonderful weekend. On Monday, we've got something a little bit different for you. We'll have a little bit with Bill Kristol, but it's 25-year anniversary of Columbine tomorrow. Mm-hmm. I grew up right by Columbine. And so we're going to talk about that on Monday. So bear down for that. But in the meantime, I hope there's beautiful weather where you are. Enjoy your weekend. Amanda Carpenter, I love you. I appreciate you and hope to have you back again soon.
Great. Have a good weekend.
We'll see y'all on Monday. Peace.
Touchdown. I'm so grateful. Numbers so low. Bitch, be thankful. They say don't let money change you. That's how we know money ain't you. Bitch, I been had. Bitches been bad. We buy big boats. Bitch, I'm sin bad. Downright sinful. Bitch, we been full. All my dope boys. We like kinfolk. Be more burn spoon. DC glass pipe. VA scent bells. About that trap life. Blew through thousands. We made millions. Cocaine soldiers. soldiers, once civilians, bought hoes Hondas, took care of children, lent my pastor, built out buildings, rapped on classics, I've been brilliant, now we blend in, we chameleons. Got the luxury to drop when he want, cause nobody else could fuck with me. What a show off. Working wrist for wrist, let's have a glow off. Fuck it, brick for brick, let's have a blow off. If we go by connections made, I can still climb ladders when complexions fade. Yeah. White on white, that's the tester. Black on black, that's the Tesla. See these diamonds in this watch face? All that shit came from pressure. They don't miss you till you gone with the wind. And they tired of dancing like a yin-yang twin. You can't have the yin without the yang, my friend. Let's bring balance to the game I'm in. Yeah. Can't escape the scale if I tried. Interstate trafficking's alive. Push. Never have I been locked up in a world of misery. I need you, darling, to set me free. I'm about to go out of my mind. I can't do without you. I'm going out of my head. I can't do without you, baby. Without you, baby, I may as well be dead. Oh, baby. Oh, baby. Come on back to me, baby. I realize I made a big mistake, baby.
The Bulwark Podcast is produced by Katie Cooper with audio engineering and editing by Jason Brown.